Thanks so much for joining us today. You know, July, coming right up, is a transition period from nesting to fledging for most birds, and we'll get an update from our next guest about that process. Bill Volkert back with us. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years and has been watching birds for well over 40. We'll look at those young birds and also talk about some things that are decreasing our bird population, and want to have you part of the conversation, of course. What questions do you have about bird behavior? How's the population in your area? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always nice to join you.
This is the time of year most birds are kind of leaving their nest. What's that transition like?
Well, first of all, I always think of April and May as the migration month, June as nesting, and now July as we're moving into that fledging period, which is really the time that birds are leaving the nest. And there really are two kind of trends for birds. In terms of nesting, there are those like ducks, geese, turkeys, and others where we refer to it as precocial young. They hatch out, they're fully feathered, and they leave the nest and follow the mother to safety and to food. Our songbirds, as the scientists refer to them as altricial young, are essentially hatched out prematurely. And so there is the need to raise and feed them in the nest. And then once they leave the nest, there's also that period of care and training that's going on. And that's really what we're seeing in fledging. And we refer to those young birds as fledglings. They're out of the nest, but not yet able to take care of themselves. Now, of course, there's in that timing of the year, there's always exceptions. Some species nest much earlier. Others will even try a second family late into the summer. And so right now, I actually have Phoebes that are back on the second nest. They raised four young. They took care of them for a little over 2 weeks, looked like they were fairly independent and time to start a new family. But you really have summer right now that's starting to pick up pace. Things are moving along. We're getting to the height of the season. And as our songbirds are getting the young out of the nest, they've got to get them on their own. And also they have to become not only independent, but strengthen up and eventually prepare for migration. So you've got July to get them out of the nest, August for them to become more independent, and eventually you have this flocking period where birds will start to move to other food resources. They'll gather locally, and some of them will actually start to form some significant flocks, and eventually they take off, which for a lot of birds begins in September, some already leaving in August. So summer marches along very quickly for these birds.
It does indeed, but this time of the year, they're pretty susceptible at this point. Is there anything we can do to watch out for them?
Well, watching, certainly, but always from a distance. So we don't want to separate the parents from the young when they're trying to take good care of them. And if we do discover nests, birds that are still nesting, leave them alone. Watch them from quite a distance. I know my Phoebes, every time I walked by, they were right off the nest and they would fly to a nearby branch, and it's kind of a distraction not to give away the nest. Well, I just simply walked around that for a couple of weeks and gave them that extra space that they needed. And I think that's probably the best we can do. And just give them that space that they need, and they'll take good care of themselves the way they always have out in nature.
Texas had some pretty bad storms this past winter, as everybody's pretty well aware. How did that affect our bird population in Wisconsin?
We saw those effects already in the early migration, and people may have recognized that some of these birds that wintered in the southern United States, unlike others that go to Central and South America, they were stuck in that weather, and there were ice storms. It's not so much the cold temperature, but the ice storms that were covering the food and freezing it. And so it really isolated that food resource from a lot of birds. Some robin populations, certainly bluebirds, took quite a hit. Eastern phoebes were noticed to be diminished. right along with the hermit thrush, song sparrows, and probably a few of the other sparrow species that winter in the southern United States. And I know bird watchers were saying there seemed to be a real scarcity of bluebirds in some parts of the state. I never saw a hermit thrush this year. Now, in migration, that's always a hard assessment for birds because, they may stop over in big numbers right in your neighborhood. They may fly on by. And so we don't get a good feel for the overall population just by that little assessment or survey right around our backyard as birds are moving through. But I think that the better information is going to come from nesting data from people and their observations throughout much of Wisconsin watching bluebirds. And I have heard people who've hosted them, numbers seem to be down. Others seem to be lucky enough to have a pair back. People in central and northern Wisconsin, where we have the nesting of hermit thrushes, I'm waiting to hear reports there if they've noticed a scarcity of birds on the nesting grounds. The big luck here would be, and cross our fingers, that they have a good, successful nesting season, that they rebuild those numbers, and hopefully they'll rebound again. But birds are under a lot of pressures, and so it gets tough. And I think that's really one of the other impacts from the changing climates, is not only do we have diminished habitat out there, as we're using more and more land for ourselves, and even diminished quality of that habitat where we have invasive species or contaminants. But then we have these storms that are becoming more frequent and more severe and making it more difficult for birds.
Jill, I think, mentioned there's another threat coming from the East Coast. And I'm not sure what talk about that.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure either, and neither are the scientists who are looking into this at this point. It seemed to have broke out around Washington, D.C., then into Virginia and surrounding states, and now there's evidence of birds into Kentucky and Indiana, and what they're showing is a crusting around the eyes and swollen faces, a lethargy. Birds seem to be losing some wariness and even inability to fly. At first, the reports of bird deaths around the Washington, D.C. area, the first speculation I heard is that perhaps it was people using excessive amounts of pesticides because of the cicada outbreaks, which, of course, cicadas are not a pest for crops or people. They just come out in every 17 years in unbelievable numbers. But it seems to be really that that was more the disease outbreak. Now, specimens have been taken to the National Wildlife Health Lab, which, by the way, is in Madison. That's one of two laboratories that the U.S. Geological Survey runs to survey for and analyze bird diseases and disease outbreaks across the whole country. And so far, we do know this. It is not West Nile virus, and it is not an influenza A. What it is, though, we're not sure, and it may even be an entirely new disease. So people have been cautioned in the eastern states to maybe shut down their feeders so we're not concentrating birds where they might be spreading these diseases. I guess I would say for us in Wisconsin, as far as we know, it hasn't gotten to our region yet. We don't know what the impact will be or how widespread or if this will run its course. But I guess a heads up for people, especially those who feed birds, watch for birds that are showing that lethargy, the lack of activity, inability to fly, if they're showing crustiness around the eyes or swollen face or other types of symptoms. And you may want to begin by reporting those to DNR. They will certainly contact the wildlife health experts, both within the state and also the federal labs. And if you are starting to see that, maybe you want to shut down your bird feeder. Besides right now, food is at a maximum. It's at its abundance, so birds have plenty of natural food. And if we can leave them spread out a little more, it's basically social distancing for birds. It'll help to reduse the rapid spread. Just same response that we had to go through. So, yeah, keep a heads up and see if we have any evidence of that within our neighborhood.
Kenneth in Janesville, what's on your mind?
Hello. I wonder what the effects of weather change has been on the birds. In that, I noticed or here outside of my living room, fledgling birds in April, and I mean early April, when the weather was fairly cold and went below freezing a couple of times, a couple of days and nights anyway. And I wonder about all of that.
And having an effect, yeah. Well, we're coming up to a break, but if you got a quick response to that, Bill, and then we can maybe pick it up after the break.
There's always a risk for those early nesters. The tree swallows are one I always worry about, and bluebirds. They start to arrive here pretty early in the year and initiate nesting, and that unpredictable early spring weather can always be a difficulty for them. Fortunately, there's always a chance to renest. But as that weather becomes less predictable, perhaps those impacts might even increase. We can talk more about that in a little bit here.
Yeah, we can indeed. Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, and he'll be with us right till 12:30 today. So you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Bill. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about bird watching with expert Bill Volkert today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years and been watching birds for a lot longer than that. So what would you like to know about attracting birds to your yard, perhaps? What about questions relating to feeding them? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Christy in Chippewa Falls has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Christy, hi.
Hi, thank you. So I'm really curious because on a wooded property near Big Lake Wissota, there's a group of standing dead poplars, and they have a lot of sign of woodpecker activity over the years. And just this week, recently, one of the holes about eye level is mostly plugged with little downy feathers, and I'm wondering what that might be about. Thank you.
I'm wondering the woodpecker hole. Little downy woodpeckers might make a hole, say, an inch and a half in diameter. Flicker will make one about 2.5, maybe to 3-inch diameter. Once they get to that size, it's big enough for wood ducks and other cavity nesting ducks. And downy feathers, I would almost expect that perhaps we had one of the ducks nesting in the cavity if it's of sufficient size. They will pluck the feathers from their breast to add a little bit of insulation and fluff within the nest. Since they don't bring other nesting material into those cavity nests. And sometimes with the birds exiting from the nest site, some of that gets caught around the edges. So that would be my guess, is you probably had one of the ducks, wood duck, hooded merganser, or in northern Wisconsin, could be a few other species that use those cavity nests.
That makes good sense. Another question relating to bird populations. What are some other reasons bird populations are declining and across the world, for that matter, across the country?
Well, the biggest one is just simply loss of habitat. As we convert more and more of our forests, grasslands, wetlands to agricultural and other uses, and the trend commonly is first we'll take that land, convert it to agriculture, and then we'll take some of the agricultural land, convert that to housing and industrial development. One way or another, it's that conversion and the overall just loss of habitat. The less places we have for birds, the less birds are out there. And I always remind people that one of the common assumptions is, well, you know, so I'll cut down this forest or change this and that, the birds will have to go somewhere else. Yes, they do, but somewhere else, if that's decent habitat, is already saturated. There is no more space, and so less space means less birds. And what we also find is that the birds that migrate the farthest are the ones that are under the greatest pressure and seem to be showing some of the bigger declines. Well, the farther distance you go, the more different human impacts you run into. whether this is the habitat that you need along the way for those big migrations, whether this is, say, contaminants within those areas that you might run into, or even structures such as windows, buildings, communication towers. Those are all different hazards. You know, one of the problems is as we monitor bird populations, and I've said this in the past, the first thing to do is just tally the birds, see what good science we can use to see how many are out there and what the trend is. If they do show some decline, then the bigger question is what is the cause? And it's not always the same. It may be more of a combination of things. But those are sometimes, especially when it's a combination of factors, are much more difficult to deal with, and to find out which ones are first the greatest impact and the ones that we can make the biggest change with. I would certainly say for homeowners, one of the biggest changes that they could make is look at your glass windows and do something there to make sure they're not a hazard for birds. A lot of birds fly into windows, and if you think about it, okay, maybe you have 4 to 6 birds a year that hit your window. Multiply that times every house out there, and it does add up to hundreds of thousands, and across the country, literally hundreds of millions of birds. And just simply by putting some obstructions on there, especially spacing 4 inches apart, different kinds of decals or stripes that can be put on windows, these are a really good deterrents. A lot of cities are also doing a lights out program. Those that have tall buildings, you can't take the building down, but they turn off the lights because these are distractions for birds. And they do that during migration. And more large cities are doing that throughout the United States and in Canada and other places in the world. So lights out program is another thing. But it gets tough to unravel. And another comment I like to make is with this possible new disease outbreak, there are really two thoughts on this, whether it's birds or even for ourselves, the COVID pandemic and other things we're seeing. Is it just that we're looking more carefully and seeing things that maybe have erupted over time in the past? And you think about it just within the last few decades. Lyme disease has really been on the uptick. We'd identified Ehrlichiosis, Burgdorferi, and other diseases in ticks. We've had SARS outbreaks, Zika virus, now the COVID pandemic for bats, the white nose syndrome. And West Nile virus was brought to this country because we're very mobile for birds, and now possibly an entirely new disease. So the question is, are we just better at detecting these things, and did this always go on in nature? Or is this a sign of ecosystem instability? And that's what ecologists are fearing, is that as we start to shrink these systems down, they become less capable of functioning as healthy ecosystems. And maybe these disease outbreaks and emergence of new diseases is a result of that, that we lose that buffering capacity. If that's the case, we're really creating some real serious problems, not just for a few birds, but perhaps ourselves and a lot of other organisms on a global scale. And so the climate change and habitat loss, those are two big things.
Mike in Milwaukee, kind of along this line, he wondered if you'd address the threat for birds from feral cats, or for that matter, house cats that their owners let run around in the neighborhood.
That is the other big thing that humans can do, is to keep cats indoors. And feral cats is a difficult one because they are seen as pets, even if they don't belong to anyone. And so removing them from the wild becomes quite controversial. But there is no doubt that cats as a non-native predator, and that's just what they are a serious threat to birds. And they are having a significant impact. And especially where birds are under enough other threats, and maybe we have a hard time addressing some of these other threats, doing something about your windows and keeping your cat indoors are two very simple solutions, along with planting your backyard to better bird habitat, make it more bird friendly, something that each of us can do right around the home. And if we get a lot of people doing this and caring about it, we can actually start to have an impact. And I think we really need to get on the bandwagon to become more connected with nature in general, and to become more engaged to start doing things right, literally in our own backyard.
Brian in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for waiting. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good, appreciate the call.
I'm curious about the status of whippoorwills. I haven't seen one in a long time. And my understanding was that they are having a tremendous problem with feral cats because they are around singing bird in the evening. And,
yeah, I don't you're know kind of breaking up there. What about whippoorwills, Bill?
Yeah, that's a bird that we certainly don't have as many around as we did in the past. There seem to be a few strongholds, which is in the west central and northwestern part of the state. I heard a report up around the Two Rivers area that there still was a population there. But I used to hear them not in big numbers, but we had a few here in the northern Kettle Moraine. And this is really the first thing that we see is as populations go down, these fringe populations start to recede toward the core. In other words, if you think of whippoorwills in the past of having a stronghold in those areas in the west, southwest part of the state, west central part, and a few other places, and then individuals scattered throughout in good habitat areas. First, we lose those scattered populations. They start to retreat. Cats, as an impact for a ground nesting bird, is one possibility. They also eat on larger insects. We know that there are less insects out there, and also concerns for contaminants among insect populations, not just here, but they migrate to Central America. Maybe there's less regulation down there in terms of pesticide use that is leading to a poor quality of food for them. This is, again, a difficult one. We don't know what all the causes are for it. But, yes, it is a worry. We certainly don't have as many whippoorwills and even nighthawks, a close relative of theirs, as we did, say, 20 years ago. And scientists are working to try to figure out what the cause is and what we can do to start to turn that around.
Stephen in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I redid a pergola, and I made it a lot taller. It's 10 feet tall, and it's going to be covered by a grape. I've noticed some cardinals that are starting to come to my yard, and I wanted to know what kind of other housing for the birds I can add to the top of the pergola where they're away from predators. And eventually they're going to have a food source with the grapes. And I have a water feature that's what attracted them to my yard. Just what can I make my yard more bird friendly, especially to add to a safe place like above the pergola?
Sure. Well, for birds like cardinals, they nest in thickets and dense shrubs. So that kind of a structure is not going to help them. But robins, phoebes are two birds that nest on shelves. Places like, say, for phoebes, under a bridge is not uncommon. They like to be sometimes near water and where there's abundant insect food they snatch out of the air. So putting a shelf under there might be an advantage for them to find a little place to put a nest. Of course, there you want to watch your placement because you're going to have bird droppings underneath it, and you don't want to have that right where you want to sit to relax. So those are two species I can think of where you might want to add a structure like that. The other one that is another bird that we've seen declines in is barn swallows. And again, they're insect eaters. Is it food quality and food abundance that's a problem? Or is it simply that we're also changing from the old wooden barns that they had access to and nested inside to now these sealed steel buildings? Or maybe a little bit of both. But again, a wooden structure, kind of like a pergola might be, where they could build a nest on. But of course, not right above where you're sitting to relax and enjoy the summer evening either. But you know, there's some options there.
And there's an extension publication that's titled, I think it's Attracting Birds to Your Yard, or Attracting Birds to Your Yard. If you would go online to the UW Extension Publications, if you just type that in, you're going to find that publication, and it gives a lot of really good advice on different plantings that you can have for attracting birds to your property. I'd recommend that as well, Stephen. Rick in Rhineland.
By the way, for a little summer reading, if someone is interested, a little bit more in-depth information, Mariette Nowak, a good friend of ours from Wisconsin, she wrote a book a few years ago, Birdscaping in the Midwest. And it really talks about how to landscape your backyard for birds. And that's an excellent reference. It's a lot more than just a couple-page handout. If you're looking for a quick introduction, yeah, certainly UW Extension, attracting birds to your backyard, and woodworking for wildlife are a nice general overview. Marriott Nowak's got a really nice in-depth review of this, and I'd recommend that as well.
And the title of it again is?
Birdscaping in the Midwest. So,
okay.
I was looking for the publisher for that. But, yeah, just search under that. Itchy Cat
It'll
Press.
Come. Yep. All right, there
but,
we
yeah,
go.
Yeah, take a look at the Midwest. An excellent reference.
Rick in Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question in regard to bird feeding. I enjoy feeding the birds. I do it year-round, but I heard your guests speak about some of the negative consequences of bird feeding. Should we not be feeding the birds seasonally or at all? I mean, is this something like not feeding other wildlife? Is that detrimental, even though I enjoy it?
Oh, okay. That's an excellent question. Well, first of all, when it comes to bird feeding, quite honestly, we do it more for ourselves than the birds. They've always found natural food out there, and studies have shown that even feeder birds in the wintertime still get 75 to 80% of their food in the wild. It's a quick stop, it's convenient, and it certainly can help birds during severe inclement weather, especially in wintertime. So the nice thing about bird feeding is it gives us that connection. We can see the birds up close. But the one thing to watch for, though, is that we're not setting up for a possible disease outbreak, especially in wintertime. Keep the feeders good and clean throughout the year, especially summertime, I should say, where the warm weather, humid weather, can lead to bacteria and fungus. But in wintertime, as birds concentrate, salmonella, the bacteria that's in the droppings, can be spread. And now that the potential of a new disease that's coming from the East Coast, I would say just watch it. If you see any signs of dead birds around your feeder, shut them down and give the birds a chance to disperse. Give them that social distancing that they need, and they'll be able to take care of themselves. But that's our connection with birds. I mean, I enjoy having the birds at the feeder. I can see them on a more regular basis. And, I certainly wouldn't say don't feed the birds. But just watch out. So if we ever do see any negative impacts, that, you know, we're doing it because we're caring about the birds, that we do shut them down and do clean your feeders periodically so that we don't have any buildup bacteria, especially something that can spread from one to another.
Rick, thanks again. Dennis in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, I got a real quick story for you. I got a front awning, and I have a house finches that build a nest every year. The first, I usually get three pairs that come to build nests in there. The first one builds the main nest, and the other two build over it. But my second pair this year, the babies were just fluffy, and I have a neighborhood falcon that comes around, and he was sitting on a railing inside, and of course he took care of them four little fuzzy birds.
Oh, geez. Well, you know, hawks have always been part of the ecosystem. They are really just culling a little bit out of that flock. And it becomes, I suppose, a little bit more heartbreaking when you have a Cooper's hawk or a falcon that is taking birds right off your bird feeder or off the nest right in front of your house. If we do have bird feeders that are starting to attract what I always call the two-tier feeding, in other words, you first lure in the songbirds and the hawk starts to hunt your feeder, shut the feeder down, give those songbirds a chance to disperse. As his luck goes down, he's going to move on a little bit. But, it's always a little unfortunate to watch, but, you know, that has been nature. The big thing here to keep in mind, though, is when natural systems are big enough, you have more than enough opportunity for birds to raise their young and for the predators out there to take a few out of it without having a long-term impact on the population. But as we compress and confine them into smaller spaces, it becomes a little more dangerous world for some of these.
Thanks, Dennis. Lyric in Blanchardville, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for this program. Your guest brought up a topic several minutes ago that was very interesting about, are we more aware of these diseases? My question would be, if the chemicals that the farmers spray on their GMO crops are killing bees and they're making our sexual chemicals in our body harder for, it's changing our human reproduction patterns. Do you think that the pesticides that is being used worldwide are changing all of our immune systems, deer, bats, bees, all of us globally?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how that affects ourselves or other organisms in terms of the immunology or even in just contamination and death or loss of vigor. They're certainly targeted to try to reduce pests, but it's hard to say kill only the things you want and not everything else. You know, we've certainly noticed the decline of insect populations across North America and in Europe. I guess I would say you just look at a simple windshield survey. Think about a couple of decades ago, people would drive their car around, how many insects you'd splatter on a windshield on a summer evening compared to now. And I've said it some time ago already that, well, we decided to declare war on insects. We thought that they were the pests, they were the problem, and that we could solve a lot of problems by getting rid of them. Unfortunately, we're winning. We've declared war, and yeah, we've really knocked them down, but we're now starting to see the repercussions of that. And it's not all for the good. So, yeah, there are some negatives, no doubt. And we're going to have to try to figure out how we can better live with nature. And I guess I'd leave people also with one more thought. The caller a little while ago talked about whippoorwills and not seeing them. Of course, we hardly see them because they're nocturnal bird, but to hear them. Think about what a loss it would be never to hear a whippoorwill again.
Yeah, man. That's not a happy thought at all, Bill.
But I also want to put it at a good spin on this. You know, we're at a crossroads. We are starting to see human impacts. We are starting to see declines of populations. But there's time to do something about it. And in the same way that we are the source of the problems for wildlife and nature, we're also the only solution. And we're gonna have to start taking this seriously because we're the ones who are gonna benefit by having them around to be able to see and enjoy them and know we did some good.
Well, Bill, it's always a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Are you out bird watching later today?
Yeah, we had a little break in the green. I'm doing a little work indoors right now. I got a project on my desk, but yeah, we certainly, anytime I go by the window, I've watched the feeders. The downy woodpeckers are bringing their young and feeding them, and I see the grosbeaks are coming in. I'm waiting for the young to show up. I'm sure they're nesting right in our woods here. So, yeah, we keep a watch on them always. It's hard not to.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it, Bill.
I'm always glad to be with you, Larry. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah, I do too. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years and been watching birds for a long, long time. He and his wife went all the way around the world on a trek to see how many species of birds they could find, and he found a lot of them. A good guy and fun to have him with us. Just looking ahead, tomorrow we'll talk about the Indigenous Research Gardens at UW-Madison at 11. Then at 11:45, take a look at a new book that details top Wisconsin wildflower hikes. That's Wednesday on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mehler.